Welcome to the Unconquered Podcast.
Lethal simplicity. Yeah, I like to score fast. It's hard not to be a Noles fan. Get Florida State back. I want a damn good defense. We're still undefeated. Blame no one. Make no excuses. Do something.
Welcome back to the Unconquered Podcast, everybody. I'm your host, Jason Staples. Lots to talk about today. Lots to talk about. Willie Taggart has hired the final two coaches of the 10 who will be his assistant coaching staff. So we'll talk about the final two additions and do a little bit of evaluation of the staff as a whole and how those pieces look to fit together. Also going to talk a little bit about the schedule. Florida State's schedule has been released. So talk just a little bit about that and some early reflections on how things look going into the 2018 season, given where games fall on the schedule and all of that, which obviously, as we saw this last year, can matter quite a bit. If you're a little over front loaded or say a hurricane happens to postpone one game, that can dramatically affect a lot of things and cause things to spiral. Not that we expect anything of that sort to happen. With this coaching staff, lots of reasons to be much more optimistic, both about the coaching staff and about the schedule. But we'll get to that all in just a moment. Now, before we do that, I'm proud to and excited to welcome a new sponsor to the show, Resolution Home Loans. Now, these guys, Chad and Shannon, are diehard Noles, Unconquered Podcast listeners. Chad reached out to me back in December. Just a little bit before Christmas, and he pointed out that as mortgage originators, they're a natural pairing with Luis Marquez, who, as you all longtime listeners have known, Luis has been a sponsor of this show for quite a long time, that they naturally pair with that sponsorship. So you know, obviously very excited to welcome them on board. Now, the thing is, I don't want to just accept sponsorship from just anybody who offers. So I took some time to look into these guys, and I got to say, I'm really excited to have them on board. Chad, for example, is one of those disciplined, hardworking, I want to say nut jobs, but just so disciplined and hardworking, manages to get up at about 4:15 every morning. He gets more done between 5 and 9 a.m. than most of us get done all day. I'm telling you, Chad and Shannon are the kinds of people you want to work with, and not just because they're fellow Noles. As for Resolution Home Loans and how they go about things, they'll underwrite your loan up front before you go through the buying process, so you don't have to worry about a deal falling through. But it's their Almost Home program that really sets them apart. They'll guarantee that you'll close within 15 days or the contract closing date, or they'll give you $500 off your closing cost. That's the kind of elite closing speed you'd expect from FSU alums. Now, give them a call at 844-FSU-LOAN. That's a number specifically set up for podcast listeners and FSU folks who want to deal directly with Chad, who's in South Florida, and Shannon, who's in Tallahassee, or you can visit fsuhomeloans.com. All that information, of course, in the show notes. Just let them know that you heard about them through the Unconquered Podcast, and you'll get some additional perks and obviously help this podcast out a bunch. If you do wind up closing with them and tweet your success story with the Unconquered Podcast hashtag, I'll also throw in a free item of your choice from the growing Unconquered Podcast shop. Once again, very excited to have those guys on board as sponsors. Very much appreciate Resolution Home Loans for helping me to do what I'm able to do here on this podcast. In any case, let's get to it. Walt Bell, the hire for Florida State, hiring him away from Maryland, where he was the offensive coordinator and quarterback's coach. Willie Taggart hired him to do the same job at Florida State. Now, Taggart will still be the primary play caller at Florida State. Talk about that in a few minutes. But he did bring this guy in to work directly with quarterbacks and to be the offensive coordinator, which this is often misunderstood, that an offensive coordinator, the responsibilities of an offensive coordinator vastly exceed that of just calling plays. A lot of people think, well, you know, if he's not calling plays, he's just the offensive coordinator in name only. Not really true. Offensive coordinator is about coordination. That involves practice plans. That involves writing scripts for practices. That involves game plans. That involves scripting plays. That involves all of these various things. That involves making sure that what your receivers are working on in their individual periods works together hand in glove with what your quarterbacks are working on in their individual period. And your running backs, that what they're going to be doing is again, it's making sure that all of this stuff is properly coordinated so that when you get the whole together, it's at least as strong as the sum of the parts. And that's one of those things that sometimes you can have, say, an offense or a defense where the play calling is fine, but the coordination isn't very good. And that the coordination problems might be in practice rather than in games that cause maybe the offensive line isn't quite executing the way that it should on this play. Even though it's the right play call, given the defense, they're not executing it properly because over the course of the week and the way that they've prepared, the coordination hasn't been there, the preparation hasn't been suitable, and so the play fails. And, you know, people may blame play calling or whatever, but a lot of times it's a lot more complicated than that. And that was where it was really important for Taggart, who is going to call the plays, like I said, and he's going to serve, at least in large measure, as coordinating a lot of that stuff on offense. He is the final coordinator in that sense. And what the head coach really does is the head coach oversees the coordinators, whether that's a passing game coordinator and a run game coordinator on offense, or an offensive coordinator who's underneath the head coach on offense and the defensive coordinator on defense, you know, all of these various things. That head coach has to set the vision, has to oversee the implementation of that game plan. For an offensive head coach, that offensive head coach is usually going to have a lot of say, is going to be the one that sets the vision, again, directs where that game plan is going, does a lot of that game planning, does a lot of the coordination responsibilities. But it's really, really important for a head coach to have someone that he can depend upon to take some of that load off in terms of the coordination side of things. Play calling doesn't really add a tremendous amount of time or burden on coaches, depending on how they do it. Now, some coaches will say, well, you know, it requires that much more additional film or whatever to call those plays. And sometimes that can be true, again, depending on the approach that you take with play calling. But particularly for, say, a tempo team, let's say, you know, if I were doing this, one of the ways that I would do this is if I were calling plays from the sideline, I'd want to have at least two sets of eyes upstairs that are looking at the charts that we put together. So my play sheet, I'm going to have first and 10 play calls. I'm going to have, you know, so my neutral down play calls, first and 10, second and six. I'm going to have my second long play calls. I'm going to have my third and six to 12 play calls. I'm going to have my third and five to three play calls. I'm going to have my third and short play calls. I'm going to have my goal line play calls. I'm going to have my shot plays. I'm going to have my chunk plays. I'm going to have all of those things split out under those categories by situation. And over the course of the week, and actually during the off season, when you're first doing this preparation actually starts now. And they're going to be just a little behind on this because of how much they're putting into recruiting. They've had to put in recruiting on that, but they'll be able to catch up. But in, say, February and during spring, and then that period immediately following spring, what you're doing is you're going through film and rosters and personnel and all this of all the teams that you're going to play, and you're already establishing a preliminary game plan at that time. So by the early summer, by midsummer, you have all that stuff done. You have a preliminary game plan, and you have notes that you've taken as a staff, and different staffers are responsible for breaking down different parts, and you have your quality control people, your GAs and such to do a lot of that as well. But you have a preliminary game plan to basically help as you go into the season. Now, then that gets refined so that by the time you go into game one, that's tweaked a little bit based on what you've gathered from news sources and various things about that team and, you know, maybe injuries that they've had or different newcomers that they've had, all of that up into game one. And then after game one, you're now starting to revise every preliminary report that you've got that you prepared during the offseason. So what happens is you finish that game on Saturday generally. you make sure that you grade the film, or, you know, usually you, these days you're getting GAs or QCs that are doing a lot of the film grading, but you, you finalize the film grades. And then Sunday you're already working on the next week's preparation. And the place that starts is you pull out that prior game plan, the game plan that you'd prepared in the off season. And then you basically try to, you're watching film and you're updating that based on, again, personnel, different things that you're already seeing that are different from what they did last year and all that. And the further into the season you go, the more changes there are to make. And each week, there's different people on staff, whether that be QCs, GAs, or specific assistants that are designated a particular team to be, you know, they're say two or three teams that they keep up with each week in addition to doing the stuff that they're doing for that week. Right. So you make a couple of adjustments. If you take a few notes on what Clemson is doing in week one, you say, okay, that happened in week one. I'm going to look at that just a little bit. That stuff's already going on. And that's how this stuff is working. And in the process of doing that, you say they really like to do this defensively on neutral downs. This is what they've done against what we like to do on neutral downs. This is their history for that. So then you already plan play calls. You script effectively a series of play calls, and there's, you know, different numbers that you may get for each situation, but you need to have 5-6 calls, say, that are automatic, essentially scripted options for, say, 3rd and 6 or more. 3rd and 6 to 12, you've got scripted options prepared based on what they like to do against what you like to do. So the play calling process then becomes, okay, it's 3rd and 6. Here are our 4 options that we laid out during the week. Which one are we going to choose? And then you've got your, you know, your generic, your blind calls as well. I should mention those as well. Your blind calls, which, you know, you want to have, which include options and all sorts of things, so that you've got answers for everything built into those blind calls. And blind calls were a real emphasis of Jimbo Fisher's offense, something that he does especially well. But basically the play calling process very much works from that. And then eventually sometimes you do go away from the sheet with different things, but you're pulling from that. Now, what I want is I want to have two really good sets of eyes responsible upstairs for thinking ahead. It's first down. We're running this play. This play has a couple different possible outcomes. What are our possible play? What play calls are you looking at in your area? So let's say you're more of the pass game guy, which would be where Bell is. What are your potential play calls for, let's say, 2nd and 12, 2nd and 10 or 2nd and 12, you know, that 2nd and long? What are our couple options there? You narrow that down. Run game coordinator, which might be Fry. He might be on the sideline. He might not be, but run game coordinator may have another call that's a run call. And then you're on the phones, and as the play happens and you see the outcome of the play, you're calling up and you're saying, okay, so what do you got? And the person may come call down with, this is what I'm thinking, you know, one of these two, or this is my call. Coach, the head coach also has the play sheet and may overrule it. The final call of the play caller, the final play caller may be different than what he gets, but you're having people kind of collaboratively work through the play calling process. And when you're going fast, a lot of times that is precisely how you need to do it. Now, some coaches don't do it that way. They just have somebody upstairs who's helping them with the personnel that's out there and so on, but they don't really want to hear the potential play calls. They just want to hear, okay, they're in nickel. They're in three man nickel. They're an odd nickel. You know, they just brought in such and such, and then the coach makes the call unilaterally. Some guys prefer that, but there are other ways to do this. And the bottom line is, I think Taggart is going to find with how he's brought some guys in that are capable of calling plays or capable of running offenses and so on. I think there's going to be some degree of collaboration, specifically, certainly during the week. There's going to be a lot of collaboration with those guys on, okay, what do you like? What are we going to do? And this is something that I think is maybe the most encouraging thing about who Taggart's hired, not just on offense, but on defense. And that's that he has very clearly and very consciously sought out strong voices for those meeting rooms. You look at the offensive meeting room, and there's guys who can speak up, who've run their own offenses, who have their own opinions, who are going to be able to come in and say, I like this. I don't like that. This is why I think this will work. And this is why I don't think that'll work. It's important that you have multiple strong opinions in that film room. But again, that you want in your coach's meeting room, you want to have a common vision. You want to know where you're going. Philosophically, you want to be largely in agreement. I think he's done a really good job on the offensive side of building that. I mean, you go down the list, Walt Bell has run his own offense for multiple years now. He had a 40-plus point per game offense two different years under Anderson at Arkansas State before moving on to Maryland, where he had a positive impact on that offense. Now, they lost their starting two quarterbacks. Actually, they were down to their fourth or fifth quarterback at one point during the season. And actually, that's one of the most bizarre things. You think about Florida State last year lost their starting quarterback and were down to a true freshman, non-early enrollee quarterback last year, starting quarterback. And then they replaced their coach with another coach who lost his starting quarterback and was playing a true freshman, non-early enrollee quarterback at Oregon. Wow. Okay, so a little bit of bad luck pooling there. And then that coach hires an offensive coordinator quarterbacks coach from Maryland who had even worse quarterback luck and was down to their, you know, they were playing walk-ons at quarterback at one point. They're playing a walk-on at quarterback. I don't know that I've ever seen that before where you have the two new coaches coaching on offense, the two new primary offensive coaches that are going to be working with quarterbacks, each lost their quarterbacks or multiple quarterbacks the year before, and they're coming in to take over a program that lost its quarterback the year before. That's, wow. Maybe the good thing here is that they've gotten all the bad luck, the quarterback injury bad luck out of the way for a while, so they're going to be healthy for the foreseeable future. You know, that's what one can hope. But in any case, Taggart has done a really good job of going out and getting someone. I think with Bell, he's got someone who is who's going to work well in terms of philosophically and in terms of the vision that Bell has and the experience that Bell has. That not only does he know how to run his own offense, but that what he does offensively dovetails really nicely with what Taggart wants to do. Now, I will say this, it also signals a little bit of where Taggart wants to pivot in terms of his offense, because Taggart's offense is really flexible. He can do a lot of different things and has done a lot of different things. And I've specifically been told not to expect them to look offensively exactly like what they did at Oregon, that they're going to go a little bit more back towards some of what they did at USF, rather than just the warp speed stuff that they did at Oregon, which they pulled from a lot of what Helfrich had done and you know, had been left over from Kelly, from Chip Kelly on that prior stuff. They pulled a lot of that in what they implemented at Oregon because those players were accustomed to it. They're going to do a little bit of other stuff that they preferred doing a little bit more when they were running the Gulf Coast offense at USF. So they'll do a little bit more of that. But I will say this. Hiring Bell tells me that they definitely want to go fast and they definitely want to include a little bit more quarterback running game, at least keeping teams honest with the quarterback. I don't think they're going to run the quarterback that much, but in terms of keeping that 11-man running game in there as an option, you know, running the quarterback say 5-6 times a game to keep teams honest. They're definitely going to incorporate a lot of those option principles, maybe more than they did at Oregon, with what they did at Florida State, if the Bell hire is any indication. The other thing that the Bell hire indicates, though, is that they're going to have a more robust passing game as well. Because, again, you look at what Bell has done in the past. He was a QC under Mike Gundy and then came to UNC with Anderson to coach under Larry Fedora. So he coached in the Fedora system, which I know really well at this point, having covered it for, 5 years now? Something like that? Wow, I didn't realize it'd been that long. But anyway, you know, the Fedora offense was developed from the old Flexbone. And then Fedora basically just took the wingbacks from the Flexbone and put them into the slot and then developed his offense from there, putting the quarterback in the shotgun and the wingbacks in the slot. He was one of the early innovators on that. So his offense very much developed out of those triple option concepts into the spread very consciously. But then Fedora and Anderson put a lot of pro passing concepts and packaged those pro passing concepts with that system. And that's what Anderson took to Arkansas and dominated down there with Walt Bell calling the plays. They would go fast, and they packaged that spread option stuff, which they didn't need to run the quarterback a ton, but they ran him just enough. But they packaged that spreads, that more traditional spread running game with a lot of pro concepts downfield. So that's going to be an interesting pairing. I'm interested to see how they do that. But I think that this indicates that Taggart definitely has a clear vision of what he wants to do with Florida State in terms of the offense and what he's working with in terms of personnel and his vision. He hired to that vision. And again, Bell's going to have a strong voice in that meeting room. Another strong voice in that meeting room is going to be the wide receivers hire, David Kelly. And some people are looking at this hire and going, oh, so they settled for Kelly. That's crazy talk. I've known David Kelly for a while. David Kelly, first of all, is one of the best talent evaluators in the business, without question. That guy can recognize and project talent better than just about anybody else. Secondly, he's been a successful wide receivers coach at five other FBS programs: Stanford, Georgia Tech, Duke, USF, or UCF, I'm sorry, UCF. He was in line to take the UCF head coaching job after George O'Leary, and when he actually ended up getting pushed out due to some circumstances beyond his control at UCF, when he left UCF, UCF wound up tanking, partly because Kelly wasn't there anymore. This is a guy you want on the recruiting trail. He's one of the better wide receiver coaches in the country and has tremendous experience coaching wide receivers in numerous different offenses. He's a guy that's going to hold players accountable. This is a good hire. And if nobody would have batted an eye had Kelly been the hire the day after, the wide receivers coach hire the day after Taggart took the job. But Taggart pursued Ron Dugans, which would have been nice because not only are you hiring a really good wide receivers coach, you're also hurting your rival by pulling him. And he interviewed a couple others. But the reality is that David Kelly is every bit as good a wide receivers coach as any of the others that Taggart interviewed. And having him on the recruiting trail is certainly not going to be a bad thing. And that's another strong voice in that meeting room. Fry, a strong voice in that meeting room. A guy who knows how to coach the offensive line, but not just coach the offensive line. He knows run game scheme really well. He's done it in a lot of different offensive systems, and he's going to have a strong voice in terms of how to go about this. Dante Pimpleton he's coordinated an offense before as well. There's three guys on this offensive staff, including Taggart, that have run their own offense. And then you got Telly Lockett, who was a head coach. Yes, at the high school level, but head coach is head coach. There's a lot of strong voices in that meeting room. That's a really, really, really good thing for a staff. And these are strong voices that have a lot of commonality in terms of their vision. This is I think this staff is going to be able to hit the ground running. There's going to be a lot of good chemistry here in terms of how he put this staff together. Now, before flipping over to the defensive side, talking about that, I want to thank the other sponsor of this show one more time. That is, of course, Luis Marquez from Keller Williams Realty in Jacksonville, Florida. As you know, Luis is not just a realtor. He's a trained photographer and videographer. He's going to make sure that you have the most successful online marketing plan possible, including the best possible photos and smooth walkthrough video. If you are in the Jacksonville area, you're thinking about listing your house, give Luis a call. Information is in the show notes. Mention you heard about him through this podcast, and he'll include a free warranty on the home. He'll make sure to take care of you. And if you need to buy a home, definitely go through Lewis. He will not be outworked. And also, when you're buying a home, make sure you go through Resolution Home Loans to secure the mortgage on that home. All right, let's go ahead and get back to it. Now, as far as the defensive staff is complete. The defensive staff also, the other thing that really sticks out to me about this is the defensive staff, again, has a lot, not only a lot of strong voices in the room with experience, but again, guys that are going to gel well together. I talked about this on the last podcast, so I won't belabor the point, but one of the things that really stuck with me when I was talking to guys who coached with Harlan Barnett before is how good a fit he's going to be personality-wise and values-wise with Odell Higgins, which was not always true with some of the other guys that have been on staff in recent years. And then he's bringing his guy, Mark Snyder, who's been a defensive coordinator and a head coach before as well. And then Raymond Woody has been a defensive coordinator before. So you're looking at that room has a lot of experience on guys that have run their own teams, that have run their own defenses, and they're going to be able to come in and say, you know, when we did that, that didn't work. I don't think that's a good idea. Multiple eyes that are going to be able to help with experience. And then Alonzo Hampton, a good recruiter in Georgia, somebody else who has experience working with defensive backs. It's a really, really, really good staff. And again, to me, the thing that sticks out is how good the chemistry should be on this staff. How much synergy there should be in terms of the different voices in the room. And none of these guys, I've not heard from anyone that I've talked to, and I've talked to people who've coached with some of these guys. I've not heard from anyone that any of these people, that any of these coaches is difficult to work with or a prima donna or, you know, tends to cause any problem. These are people who are going to work really well together. That's a huge, huge, huge plus. I've already been asked a lot, and actually I'll go ahead and push this forward instead of pushing it into the mailbag portion of the show. I was asked, Seminole Maddie on Twitter was the latest person to ask this, but I've been asked multiple times, now that the staff's complete, what's your overall take? Could you assign a grade to Willie Taggart for the staff he's assembled? Is the future bright or is the sky falling as Trident would have us all believe? Oh, geez. Yeah, so first of all, I'm not going to assign a grade to the staff or to individual staff members. I just don't think that's something I'm capable of doing. I know enough to know when I don't know certain things, right? So it's basically impossible to grade staffs in advance in that kind of granular fashion. First of all, I don't know. I've not watched any of these coaches for weeks on end or for a year, multiple years in practice with players and so on, or in camps, to be able to assess how good a coach is this guy really? How good is he really? I can't really do that. So what I can do is I can assess based on what I've been told by other people. And I mentioned on the prior podcast stuff I'd been told about Harlan Barnett. I'm convinced based on the feedback from other people who've coached with him for years and people that I trust that that guy is a great hire. But can I assign like, he's an A-plus hire or a B-plus hire or an A-minus hire? I can't really do that because a lot of that comes down to how well is he going to gel with the players once he gets there? And some of that's just personality fit. Some of that has to do with, how Taggart handles things at the top. I know Odell Higgins is an A-plus hire. That much I can give. I know that, again, if I'm hiring a staff, I want a group that's going to have a common vision, but it's going to have enough diversity of thought in terms of schematic backgrounds and so on, that they're going to be able to have multiple strong voices in the room, preferably guys who've got some experience, and I want quality recruiters. That's this staff. I'd mentioned previously on different podcasts that Jimbo Fisher was frustrated by the lack of voices in his meeting, in his offensive meeting room in particular, the last couple of years, and the defensive meeting room was a mess. That's not going to be the case with this staff. So what I can say is that I think that this is a successful, it's a better staff than I expected him to be able to put together. When he was hired, I told people on this podcast, don't expect Crystal Ball to come with him. Partly because he may have a chance at that Oregon job, which he ended up getting, and partly because I'd been told that Cristobal was really not someone who would be likely to want to put the FSU logo on. He's just a Cane, and he would resist that. He's just one of those guys who actually, for whom that would matter. And I expected him to hire Jim Leavitt as the defensive coordinator. And that would have been a great hire. I mean, I talked about that then. That would have been a really, really good hire, a hire I would have been excited about. But, you know, Jim Leavitt decided to stay. He got offered more than he could refuse and, decided to stay. What surprises me is I think there's reason to think that the combination of Harlan Barnett and Mark Snyder is actually better than what we would have gotten, what you would have seen had Florida State been able to hire Jim Leavitt. And of course, you know, Leavitt, with the reason that he had to step down from USF to begin with, in terms of recruiting, Barnett is definitely a jump up from that. But the combination of Barnett and Snyder and the experience there and the quality of coaching there, you can make a case that Florida State dodged a bullet and actually wound up better off not getting the guy that was originally slated for that position. Greg Fry is a much better offensive line coach than I thought they'd be able to attract. I didn't think Taggart would be able to get a Greg Fry, at least not in year one. And to me, Greg Fry, from, again, outside looking in, it's hard to assess this stuff. From what little I know, Greg Fry is a way better hire than I expected. And I didn't think he'd be able to get a Walt Bell at offensive coordinator, especially not calling his own plays. Usually when you're going to get a guy of that level of talent, you're going to have to turn over the play calling to him. Bell is coming knowing he's not going to be the primary play caller. That's wizardry. I mean, listen, working up here, working around the UNC program up here, Walt Bell is still really, really respected at UNC. And he was like 27 when he was when he left Carolina. Something like that, 28 maybe. And Larry Fedora tried to keep him on staff. And I can't verify this for sure, but from what I understand, Fedora wanted him to stay, not only to stay on staff when Anderson left, but to replace him as the offensive coordinator. And you're talking about a guy that was like 28. That's how highly Larry Fedora thought of him. This is a Lincoln Riley type offensive coordinator, a Lincoln Riley type mind that you're looking at in terms of his reputation in the coaching community. And Taggart got him despite saying, you're not going to be the primary play caller. That's wizardry. This is a better staff than I expected. So I can't give it I can't give it an A grade or a B grade or whatever. I can't grade that. I just, like I said, I don't have enough information to be able to do that. You can do that in hindsight, but what I do know is that it's a better collection of coaches in terms of their reputation, in terms of what I know from people I've talked to around the industry, people who've coached with them. And again, I've got some contacts who have a lot of knowledge about Walt Bell because of the UNC connection. I didn't expect it to be this good. And I didn't expect him to be able to hire people that were this highly regarded across the board. So, and certainly this is going to, I'll just say this. There is not a weak recruiter on the staff. There is not a single guy that you look at on this staff and you're like, he needs some support from some of the other stud recruiters on the class or in on the coaching staff. I mean, I look down the list. I don't think there's a non-excellent or very good recruiter on the list. Every coach on this list is a very good to excellent to absolute stud of a recruiter. All 10 plus Taggart. That definitely helps. All right. So actually, you know what? I'm going to answer a couple other things in terms of one other thing I forgot to mention on the last podcast, and this was just a quick aside. When I'd been talking to one Florida State staffer at AFCA, that staffer had mentioned that a rude awakening. Actually said, what was it? These boys are in for a shock starting tomorrow. And this was when guys were about to report back for school and start the off-season conditioning program and other things. He said, these boys are in for a serious shock. because he already had, he'd been apprised of what they were going to be doing. And this is not just a matter, I mean, this is something we hear every time there's any sort of coaching change, or every offseason we hear, oh, they're working harder than they ever have. That's, you know, there's a lot of leadership and so on. I mean, it's hard to avoid that. I mean, you can go back and look up, you know, the stuff when Jimbo Fisher took over. What is Fisher going to bring to this program? Well, he's going to bring accountability. He's going to modernize, you know, the strength program. He's going to, all of these things have been heard before. They've been done before. They've been said before. But I did get some specifics in terms of, here's some stuff that, you know, that they're not used to, that they're going to have to deal with. Number one, there ain't no just come and go as you please in terms of the weight room and, you know, all this stuff around the facility of, oh yeah, you know, just kind of come on by whenever you feel like it and do your lifting. Nope. Players are assigned, this is your time. You come in and you do your work together with the guys that are assigned to do it then at that time. And you're going to do this specific stuff according to this schedule. Their days are scheduled out. And he said, there's not a whole lot of room for these guys to kind of just wander around or do whatever, because they're going to be, you know, they're going to be lifting at, this is the time that you come in and you do this lift. This is when you're assigned to do it. This is the time when you go to study hall. This is the time that's set aside for the, so they're much more scheduled. Everything's more scheduled than it has been in the past. And in terms of grade requirements, in terms of what's expected and what's going to be allowed, don't expect to get on the field if you have a 2.1 GPA. You ain't playing under Willie if you've got a 2.1 GPA. That's not going to be tolerated. So you're going to be here, you're going to study, and you're going to get your work done, and you're going to have a better GPA than that, because that's just how we do things here. It's like, this is some of the stuff. They're in for a little bit of a shock when they realize how regimented some of this stuff is going to be. And that's a real positive, because there were a lot of complaints, particularly from some staffers, some actually Florida State assistants who had some complaints about the way that things were done, say in the last by the last strength coaching group. I mean, I know one of those criticisms was that you know, they were more concerned about making sure that they looked good for the NFL scouts, which meant getting the guys that were going to be first, second, third round draft pick guys. Making sure that, you know, they were able to make themselves look good by those guys, rather than really focusing on the meat, on the middle of the team and the bottom part of the team. And when you regiment things the way that they're doing it, what you're doing is you're saying nobody's allowed to fall through the cracks. That guy who's just going to do what he's asked to do, who's going to do what he's told, the level of effort that's required from that guy is going to go way up. Now, the top guys are still going to do the extra stuff. They're still going to go the extra mile. They're still going to have some leeway built in for that. But everybody's going to be required to do specific stuff a little bit more than it was in the past. So that's another thing that I forgot to mention actually on the last podcast. It was a little bit of a discussion. I tweeted it out at some point about that, there being a little bit of a rude awakening there, a little bit of a shock coming. And I talked about a little bit prior, talking to some people who knew how things were going to go, that there was going to be an emphasis right up front on discipline and on restoring that discipline, that pride rather than swagger. We talked about that a couple podcasts ago, but anyway, that's worth mentioning. Now I'm going to actually save, I'm going to wait to discuss the schedule, until the next podcast. I don't want to spend too much time on that in this one, and that's a good subject for its own podcast. So I'm gonna get to a few more questions that I've left out in the past. Here's a question from Andrew Marsh. Can you tell me what happened with Hockman last year? If not for injury, would he have been the guy? And was his injury to the point where he was missing extended practice time? So what I was told, and I actually don't know the whole situation here, so, you know, I have limited knowledge as well, but I was told a few things. One is that Hockman was good in camp. He was doing well, but that Blackman started basically catching up to him by about the end of the second week of camp. That he was looking more or less, he was starting to break even with Hockman even then. And then Hockman ended up getting that injury where he was not able to throw with the kind of power and so on that he needed to. This is another criticism of Fisher, that again, after a guy leaves, you hear all the criticisms from everybody. So take it with for a grain of salt. But, you know, he had his quarterbacks basically throwing their arms off. They'd throw, you know, 700-800 balls in a couple practices. And that's something that you do have to manage your pitch count, your player's pitch count. And I've been told that Fisher didn't always manage his player's pitch count all that well. And so that's why you'd see, you know, EJ, his arm got tired late in the year, and Ponder, you know, his arm started getting tired at different points. And even Jameis was showing some effects of that. And one guy who I talked to about this said, you know, Jameis had the benefit, you know, he didn't show as much wear on that because he was out of here by the time he was done as a sophomore. So he didn't throw so often every practice. And so anyway, Hockman, you know, the pitch count was really high in camp, and his arm, you know, flared up. And so he had to step away and not take all those reps. And that's what gave Blackman the chance, not only to be even, but to pull significantly ahead. And so that's where that happened. I don't know whether he'd have been the guy had that not happened. I don't know that anybody knows that answer. Maybe Fisher would. But I think he would have at least had more of a chance. Now, once Blackman took over, then actually things kind of got difficult because Hockman essentially went through individual drills the rest of the year, but then didn't essentially take a snap the rest of the year in practice. He didn't run the scout team because they knew that they might need him if Blackman got hurt. But he also wasn't taking backup reps because JJ was taking those. And so and they were wanting Blackman to take every possible additional rep he could in practice because, you know, there was need of him to get all those extra reps. So what ended up happening is he would just stand and basically have to get mental reps the rest of the year, which obviously was very frustrating for him. It was not the best for his development. It was a little bit of it was not the way it was intended to be, but it was sort of by necessity because of what happened in terms of Francois' injury. Now that means that Hockman is he did, you know, get prepped in terms of game planning and all that. He got a sense of how that works in season. He just didn't get any physical reps really. Now how that's going to work out for the spring, it's a totally new offense. He's going to have a chance. So yeah, that's worth mentioning. Okay. Last question I'm going to handle today. And yes, I know I'm still putting off a couple, really big ones, but they're going to take, I think I'm probably going to have to do a whole episode on them. In any case, the last one from Tim Flynn, could you give a breakdown on how those goofy signs are used for signaling in plays? I'll do a very short answer to this. Number one is the teams that use those goofy signs, all of them use them a little differently. So, and in some cases, those goofy signs are dummies. So they don't actually do anything, and the players are looking to someone else for signals. So it's a way of misdirecting. So sometimes that's the case. But generally, the way that this works is that signs are broken down. So you'll have, say, four pictures or whatever, and each of the four areas means something. So you might have the offensive line is supposed to look in the top left. The wide receivers and quarterback, you know, if it's a pass play or whatever, are supposed to look in the top right. You might have the running backs and offensive line look in the bottom left. And then you have, say, the bottom right is a formation call. You might have that. So if you're going really fast, you might have, again, these are situations where you have, say, 7 or 8 or 10 specific calls that are designated as these. We're going to go through a bunch this game in, say, 1st and 10 calls or whatever. You know that you're going to have these four that you're going to do a lot, and you want to be able to go fast. Then you cycle those cards. You specifically draw up those cards. So you might have, say, you know, birds this week are going to be outside zone or inside zone, say a bird. You know, if you see top right is a bird, then that's going to be inside zone no matter what. And so you'll have several cards that are going to have inside zone. And this works really well for teams that do a lot of RPO plays where you'll have, say, inside zone tagged with a bubble or whatever. So now you have a full play that can be either a run or a pass play that was just called with Cardinal. Inside zone, quarterback reads at the line of scrimmage whether or not it's going to become a pass play or whether it's not. And you might have two different variations of inside zone. So the Cardinal goes for the offensive line and the running backs. They're doing inside zone. And then you might have, say, a smoke screen down at the bottom. So you might have somebody smoking a cigarette at the bottom left. And so that tells the receivers, no, instead of doing bubble, you're doing smoke. You know, and then you might have a jet in the bottom right-hand corner that would say jet motion. So this is, we're using jet motion. Or you might have, one of the boxes that week might be designating the call in that regard. So if you see, I know Oregon some years ago, Chip Kelly had, they used Phil Mickelson for the snap count when they went on two, because Phil Mickelson always finished second. So it's that sort of thing. You're trying to tag something that's really easy to put together for players, easy to remember, that you can get and you can go really fast with. But again, it's not stuff that you're going to necessarily call all your plays with, and different teams use them differently, and they may be used differently in different games. So, but anyway, that's a brief summary of how some of that stuff works. All right, then, that's going to go ahead and do it for us today. I'm going to go ahead and wrap here. Lots of stuff left. I'm going to talk about the schedule here soon, and I've got a couple other more philosophical or foundational questions that some folks have asked about that I want to get to as well. So I'll probably do a full episode on that. A lot of stuff coming up, but anyway, I want to thank the sponsors once again, Luis Marquez of Keller Williams in Jacksonville, and also now our newest sponsor, Resolution Home Loans. If you need anything in the home buying area, go through Luis if you're in the greater Jacksonville area, or at least, you know, ask him for a referral. Definitely still helps me out and also helps him out. And also, if you're going to buy a house, go through Resolution Home Loans for your mortgage and let them know that you heard about them from the Unconquered Podcast. This has been the Unconquered Podcast. I'm Jason Staples. Thanks for listening.
Thank you all very much, and have a great day if you want to.
I made this.